Founded in 1991 by patients, the FSH Society is the largest grassroots network of FSHD patients, their families, and research activists. The FSH Society offers a community of support, news, and information for the millions of men, women, and children affected by FSHD worldwide. This is FSH Society Radio.
Welcome, welcome one and all to the FSHD Society radio show. Thanks for being here. Hope you can hear me this show loud and clear. The gremlins are gone from the last month's episode and the fiasco that was tech issues. We move forward. We are here again. Another month is upon us, and we are hopefully having a good time here in this end of August, walking into Labor Day weekend, and glad you can spend the time with me and the FSHD Society in this episode. Got a great episode in store, and awesome guests we have coming in today. Well, not, I guess on the call lines, we're having a great guest call in. We'll not have in-studio guest. Her name is Heather Green, and she is a forensic psychologist. So I'm kind of thinking that my imagination is thinking her line of work has, you know, like the FBI, like serial killer chaser type, you know, job. That might be fun to talk about, along with a host of other different career things she has been a part of, like a singer, a model, interior designer. She's actually worked in radio, so I'm feeling a little intimidated that she's been in radio. And we're going to talk, I think, touch on a lot of those things and her careers and her FSHD story and so much more. She had an awesome article on FSHSociety.org, so you can take the time right now if you want to open up another browser window and find that. That'd be awesome. The way you can contact me, the best way, you want to get right to me, is that's FSHRadioHost@gmail.com. That's the best way to get in contact with me before, or I should say during the show, after the show. That's the best way to do it. Follow us on Twitter at FSH Society, and FSHSociety.org is the website. Or have they changed it? No, it's FSHSociety.org. They added the D, if you haven't all noticed. Let's just talk about that right now. They added the D, FSHD Society. So, use the chat room too. How could I forget? I knew there was something. Use the chat room. Go ahead, type in on there. Let me know your thoughts, feelings, what's going on in your neck of the woods. What are you doing this Labor Day? We have several people lining up now in the chat room, so I'm assuming that you all can hear me this time around. So that's awesome news. I also wanted to quickly, though, plug, before I go any further, the guest that will be on next month. The guest will be David Younger. Go to dbyounger.com. You can see his bio. That's his website. I believe he was on in the FSH Society. I think he had some type of chat going on. I think that's going to be an adult-type show. We're going to talk about intimacy, relationships, those things. So come back in September when we have that show slated on the last Wednesday of that month. Excited to bring that one to you. That would be checking for you right now. It looks like the 25th. Of September will be our next show after this with special guest David Younger. So we have that in store. We also have a request. I had a Wisconsin virtual chapter meeting just the other day this week, and they've expanded, or we've decided to expand my group, and not just to the greater Milwaukee area, but we've also decided to expand it to now Wisconsin. And I think more is even in store for the group in our area here. Might be reaching out to Minnesota a little bit and even to Michigan a little bit. So all you Minnesota people out there in Michigan, I'm coming. If you want to have a virtual meeting, you can join us. So stay tuned. We're going to start doing that, kind of joining forces. My reach is getting bigger, I guess. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, because during our virtual meeting this week, we had Natalia on from the University of Minnesota talking about her study. She is looking for participants. So if you are in the Minnesota area, I actually was a part of this study in April. And I drove up to Minnesota, and there was two studies going on. Natalia is looking for control people, so people that do not have FSHD. I unfortunately could not bring a control subject with me. I went solo, but that's what she's looking for. I believe it's a biopsy study is what they're looking for, along with some blood and blood work, urine sample they take, the muscle biopsy that they do. It's really quick. They do it like 7:30 in the mornings when they try to schedule it, and off you go. And since you're up there, there's also an exercise study going on at the University of Minnesota as well. That one is, I did that one as well. Since I was up there, I figured I might as well do both, right? I know I've talked about this before. A cardiovascular research study at the rehabilitation lab at the University of Minnesota. The study compares metabolic rates between individuals with and without FSHD. You must be 18 years or over, able to participate on a moderate exercise level. So, you know, like jumping on an exercise bike and going to some medium-ish pace. It did not exhaust me to any great degree, and my legs are not super strong. Must not have an active cardio or respiratory disorder, and you cannot be pregnant or nursing. So, how do you get in touch with the exercise study? Get your pen, paper out. I'm sure who's ever working the FSH Society chat here, maybe it's June. I see that she's been chatting in here a little bit. Her number here is 612-625-3175 or KELL0529 at umn.edu. That's for the exercise study. And I believe Natalia's email might be mdcenter@umd.edu. So there are ways to get yourself involved in there. I think even the government has, you know, going on there for the study. You can go and see what studies are open around you. I know a lot of people go to Rochester. Go ahead and do that one. But I just happened to be talking to Natalia. I happened to be talking to the people up there at University of Minnesota this week, and they're still looking for help, still trying to find just a couple more participants to continue that study going forward. So I promised her I would talk to you awesome people on the FSH Society radio show that watch via Facebook, and hopefully we could get somebody to, you know, get in contact with them up there and go for it. I did it. Not super difficult at all. I honestly got treated very well. They passed me from, you know, one part of the study to another, different parts of the building. I got lunch out of it. My room was paid for. I had reimbursement with my gas money, so it didn't cost me anything. And I think they gave me some money on top too, which I wasn't looking for that. So you do get taken care of, and your expenses are covered. I think they even cover flight if you have to fly in. So that's something you can work out with them. But there is definitely money there that is helping fund us that are going to do this. So really exciting stuff. I know I've heard awesome compliments about the FSH Society and the FSH world. Those that have this disease are usually very excited to participate and can. In this particular study, let me emphasize, they're looking for a control subject, meaning someone that does not have FSHD. So a friend or a family member that doesn't have it, that could participate. And I believe they're covering their costs as well. So something to keep in mind, something to keep in mind. Thank you for that time that I could plug that for you. What else is on our docket? What else is on our docket? When we talked to Heather Green, and I was listening, or I should say reading, her story on fshsociety.org, it's a long article, and it's well-written, and it's a fun read, interesting read, and a personal style story as well, as I'm paging through it right here, as you see me. What I couldn't help but notice is that this is a woman that goes for it. Goes for it. She goes for what she's wanted to do in her life, and she's attacked it. She's taken it on. She's been a singer, a model, interior designer, been on the radio. As I said previously, I'm a little intimidated, right? Another radio person. I am not a professional at this. So having a professional of radio on is a little intimidating for me. So at any rate, she is following her dream, right? And her ultimate dream, though, was to be a forensic psychologist. And she talks into some detail about how she accomplished that goal. And I'm really into that right now. I listen to this show called The Ken Coleman Show, talking about helping people get their dreams. Yes, that's a shameless plug. I will not get any money or credit for it, but I follow that gentleman's message. And that's getting in proximity of people that are doing what you want to do and following the dream and go do it if you can. And I know that a lot of us listening and watching this show, listening to the podcast later, that it can be more difficult. You know, what's in your wheelhouse? How can you, if you need to keep making money, maybe like for me, I've been making money by doing physical labor. Those days are numbered for me. I can sense it. So I need to start thinking, what other direction can I go? And I really hope that Heather's story inspires those that maybe are trying to seek that direction, because she was seeking that direction. She found it and she carried it through. And it's very inspiring. I love hearing people that have gone through some muck and some changes in their life and come out the other side and are super excited and doing what they want to do. And it's inspirational. So we're going to listen to her story coming up here, which if I look at the clock, we're up on the clock. So why don't we take our first break and I'll dial her up and get that conversation started after the break. You're listening to the FSH Society Radio Show.
You're listening to FSH Society Radio. Hey everyone, this is Tim, host of FSH Society Radio. And get this, in 2014, a Dutch team reported that aerobic exercise training and cognitive behavioral therapy decreased fatigue and improved the quality of life significantly for FSHD patients. This suggests a marked impact in slowing the degeneration of affected muscles. So I don't want to hear any excuses. You can get out there, get active, start exercising, and let's start fighting this thing. Hi, this is Tim again, and have you been recently diagnosed with FSHD and kind of trying to search for answers? I mean, there's so many questions. Where do you go? Well, go to fshsociety.org. Join the FSH Society. Get educated, because knowledge is power. Get active. Connect with local members. Volunteer for research and donate, because without you, we can't fight this. Go to fshsociety.org.
Hey, welcome. Welcome back to the FSH Society Radio Show. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being a part of the episode this month. And without further ado, and don't want you to wait too much longer, we're going to welcome in right now our featured guest of the show, and that is Heather Green. Heather, how are you?
Tim, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. All the equipment is working.
Good.
I have an awesome guest on the line. Yeah, and I'm super excited. And I'm glad that you could be a part of that excitement. We have already some chatter going on here on Facebook Live, as I can see, such as from Darla Hunt Homan. She says, Heather is such an inspiration. Thanks for having Heather on.
Wonderful friend.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Let's start off. Who is Heather Green? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
That's a loaded question.
Right? Yeah.
I guess I would say I'm a person who doesn't sit still very well. I'm not very happy in neutral. Let's put it that way. I have a lot of interests, and I figured a long time ago, I got one life. I think I'll try to experience as much as I can in the time allotted.
That's probably a good way to kind of live your life if you can, right? Or get at least in that mindset.
Absolutely.
And you've had quite a bit of different careers. You know, you as I've researched a little bit about you and read the great story you had on the FSHSociety.org, you were a singer, a model, interior designer. And then you mentioned to me in an email that you were also in radio, which then I got really intimidated. I'm like, oh, great. You know, this is a professional, and I am not. So yeah. This ought to be fun.
No. I wouldn't get intimidated. That was in the 80s, and things were pretty pretty crude back then. So no worries.
So why don't we, and I think right when you're talking about that, like how you say you're a go-getter and you don't want to sit still. And when I look at the story and the way your life has been going, it's very difficult for me to go, all right, let me start here with a question. It's like, let's start at this spot. So I guess, like I do with a lot of people, you kind of described yourself, but where are you now in your career life? What do you do now for a living?
Well, you know, it's funny because, like you said, I experienced many things. I enjoyed a lot of different careers and was just really blessed to, to explore a lot of different areas. But the one thing I always was fascinated with was, as weird as it was, the criminal mind. And as I found out, it's not really that weird, because now television is exploding with true crime shows and people can't get enough of it. And I've always been fascinated with how a mind can go so wrong. And if you read the article, this goes back to a time when I was young, 12 years old. We had a family friend who was murdered. I lived in a small town in Western Montana, and things like that didn't happen very often. And I lived in the Bitterroot Valley, Hamilton, and Missoula was about 45 minutes away. And my father was a minister. He had a friend who was a country minister, and his wife was brutally murdered one day. And it really made an impression on my young mind. And I thought, you know, at the time, how does a person do that? How does a person just walk in and take someone's life in such a brutal fashion? Right. And it kind of spawned this fascination with me. And, I was fascinated with all of these older murderers like Jack the Ripper and everything. And you kind of have to temper your telling people about your fascination, because you can get pegged kind of a weirdo. But I always read everything I could get my hands on. And so, it's really funny because, I was in entertainment, I was in interior design. I loved all of that. But when I was diagnosed with FSH, that's really when my life turned. And as awful as the diagnosis was, it was really strangely a jumping off point for me to examine and really jump into what I always wanted to do. And that is learn about criminals, learn about the violent mind. And not very many people know this, but our country has a lot of wonderful programs. And one of them is called vocational rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And if you've been diagnosed with some kind of illness or disability, and you can no longer do the job that you were trained to do, they have money set aside to educate and train people so that you can go into a new vocation. Mm. And so here I am with this disability. And here's this program that said, we'll train you. What do you want to do? Well, I want to be a forensic psychologist. And they said, okay, let's go.
So they didn't say, what the heck is that? They didn't say, like, are you sure?
I did get a couple of weird looks, but actually, no, I have to say the people, Jerry Zook and Carla, these people, Carla Fox in Montana, they were so wonderful. Sarah Seltzer, they got behind me 100% and said, we will pay for your education. Wow. And I said, I want a doctorate. And I had never been to college, Tim. Jeez. I didn't have any college credits. I mean, I think I took a weird class here and there, you know, whatever, at a community college, but I had no college behind me. And I was 50 years old. And I said, I want a doctorate in forensic psychology. And they said, okay, let's go.
So at this time, you're 50 years old. You know, you said that you're diagnosed with FSH. When were you diagnosed at around 50 years old?
No, I was actually diagnosed at 41.
Okay.
I was in Los Angeles at the time, and I had my interior design business going. It was thriving. Mm-hmm. I was loving it. I was raising four children. I had a really busy life, but I, you know, like a lot of other people with this disease, for many years, I was feeling these strange, you know, I suddenly couldn't pick my foot up. I couldn't raise my arm. You know, I was like, what is this? I wasn't injured. At the time, I wasn't in a lot of pain. That has changed. But I couldn't figure out what was going on. I thought MS, because I never knew adult people could get diagnosed with muscular dystrophy. That was not right. Even in my reality. And it took 10 years to get a diagnosis.
Whoa.
So I was seeing doctors off and on. 10 years. I went through two very brutal pregnancies that almost took my life. And I just couldn't figure it out. And finally, we did the DNA test, the final test, and my doctor called and said, I can't believe what we found. He was just blown away. Wow. He said, I never would have guessed muscular dystrophy, but that's what you have.
Yeah,
and
because they thought that you had, like, you know, lupus or MS possibly, those kind of things.
Yes.
And you said you weren't really experiencing a ton of pain necessarily at the time, but you were just noticing some limitations, right? Things you just couldn't do.
As a matter of fact, one day somebody asked me, why are you limping? And I thought, I'm not limping. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
And I really hadn't even noticed it. It comes on so suddenly, and for some it doesn't, but for me it did. Actually, one day I was in the shower and I looked on the wall and there was a worn spot on the wall, and I said, how in the world is there a worn spot, as if somebody had touched this place on the wall 100 times and it had worn down? I said, it's in the shower, what's going on there? I said, well, whatever. And I went to shampoo my hair and I realized I propped my elbow up on the wall right there.
Oh,
and I went,
God.
How long have I been doing that?
Huh.
And it just suddenly dawned on me, there's something wrong here.
Huh.
So
that's
that was one of the biggest. Yeah, it was really fascinating. I thought, I've been propping my arm up to wash my hair. How come I can't touch the top of my head? That's a weird thing.
You start asking people, do you have a problem lifting your, you know? Yeah. No, I know.
Exactly.
I know.
Exactly.
I always thought.
Your elbow up when you shower.
Yeah. I mean, I think I had a couple of those odd things too, where I was like, how come it seems so much harder to, like, comb the back top part of my head? That's weird. Like, why can't I do that? And then when I got the diagnosis, and I tell my wife, and she goes, that's why you put your jacket on weird. I go, I put my jacket on weird? What are you talking about? And she's like, you need, like,
exactly.
30 feet around you to put your coat on. I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. I'm like, not everybody does that?
Exactly.
She's like, no.
Right. Right. Oh. Yeah. My brother used to give me a hard time with how I danced. I'm like, see, it wasn't just that I'm weird and I'm not coordinated.
I really can't.
I have a sister who is a track star in Montana, still holds state records. And she wanted me to run with her so badly when I was a kid. And I wanted to so badly. I just couldn't. And you look back on things like that and
I
get it.
That's why. Yeah.
That's it.
now you've touched a little bit on that. You have a great, great segue, by the way, here for this next question you just did. So the radio thing is still in you. Family, you bring up family. So is there any history of FSH in your family that you know of?
None that we know of.
Yeah.
I suspect that my mother may have had a very mild case of it, because she had some sloping shoulders. She had some problems with pain in her shoulders and neck. She did have some issues with joints wearing it. Just some things that make me curious. She passed about 5 years ago, sadly, but that's the only person I could think of that may have had maybe a mild case, but really, no, nobody. I've got 4 siblings.
Yeah.
They're all very able-bodied, 4 real big go-getters, amazing, amazing people I love very much. And my father, who just passed a few months ago, sadly, and he worked in his shop until a month before he passed. So, nothing in my family. Mm-mm.
So you're a pioneer. Congratulations. That's good. That's good. You know, we all gotta be. You're a first.
Absolutely, we all gotta be known for something, right?
And you mentioned too that you have kids, because you mentioned you had 2 pregnancies that were very, very tough. How many children do you have in all? You said 4.
Actually, I raised 4.
You
I had
4.
2 stepchildren that I raised,
okay.
And then I have 2 biological children.
Mm-hmm.
I had 1 in 92 that I spent most of the time in the hospital. I had all kinds of issues and was in preterm labor the whole time. And it's really interesting because my obstetrician was the one that was ultimately responsible for getting my diagnosis. Mm. Because my first pregnancy was in 92, my second one was in 98. And 98, they were actually, with all the complications I had, they gave me 6 weeks to live at one point. And she kept saying, there is something here and I can't find it. I know there's something here. And she was the one that was responsible for sending me to UCLA for the genetic testing. She's the one that got me the amazing neurologist that finally put all the pieces together and gave me the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So it all goes back to my obstetrician, actually.
Wow.
She's wonderful. Dr. Brenda Smith in Pasadena, amazing woman. Mm-hmm. She just wasn't satisfied with saying, well, we don't know what it is, but
right.
Whatever. You know, so many doctors lose their curiosity, I think, over years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah. I mean, did you find that? Like, they just weren't curious enough.
Yeah, you know, I think I wonder that because I don't think, you know, I'm 44 right now. I was diagnosed about 4 years
okay.
ago. But I've seen a physician, and, you know, I'm not like a typical male where you avoid the doctors, you know, as you usually hear stereotyping.
Right.
I would go to the physical
right.
and this and that. And no one really noticed. I just found it astonishing. Like, no one noticed my shoulder blades before. I'm like, I've noticed them.
Right.
You know,
right.
I noticed that they always stuck out more. I'm like,
right.
whatever. I don't know what that means. I'm like, no one notices this. And
right.
it wasn't until, you know, I went from throwing a baseball to my kids to a football where it was heavier. And I felt like my arm just flew off of my body and went, whoa, that's not good. I'm like, I guess I got to get that shoulder looked at, I thought.
Right.
So in that process.
Exactly.
That's where my physician was like, there's something wrong here. There's something off. I'm not sure what this is. And he wouldn't let it go.
Right.
Yeah. He's like,
because
I'm going to send you to somebody. I think I send you. And I could tell he wasn't even sure, like, what direction. He goes, I think we're going to start. And he was like,
that.
Let's send you to an ortho.
Right.
And then we'll see what happens. I said, okay. And then that's when
sure,
the ortho,
sure.
you know, you go down the chain of doctors. But it didn't take me very long. It didn't take me 10 years. It only took me, you know, I don't know what it was, maybe only about a month. You know, I went from doctor to doctor.
Oh, wow.
And for me,
wow.
it was more
well,
of a...
That's good.
It was. I think the way it was delivered to me could have been a better bedside manner, but, you know, it's
oh,
fine.
Oh, my goodness. Same with me.
Right.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's quite a diagnosis to be handed. And, you know, for somebody to say, you're going to lose the ability to smile, probably won't be able to swallow, you know, and you have this image of someone sitting in a wheelchair drooling in their lap and you're like, oh, thanks. That's really pretty.
Good luck to you. Yeah.
And for listeners, it isn't that.
No.
it isn't that. I mean, it could be delivered with so much more sensitivity and with so much more information about it, you know, everybody experiences this disease differently.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's sucks. Nobody wants to have this disease. It sucks. It limits our abilities in some areas, but it's also the mother of invention. I mean, you know, you have to figure out other ways to get around things, and it's a challenge. But, you know, I think the people that have this disease that I've met meet that challenge with so much energy. You know, they just won't take it lying down, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, I totally agree. Go ahead.
I have to say something about one of the doctors in my journey. I won't mention his name because he's not a very nice man, but I actually told him there's something wrong with my shoulders. There's no reason why I shouldn't be able to lift my arm. And he said, well, you know, your rotator cuff is blown. You hurt your rotator cuff. I said, well, I never got injured. Yeah. You probably injured it a few years ago or whatever. And it's just in your head that you think it's going to hurt. So you don't want to lift your arm. It's all in your head thing.
It's all in your head.
And I said, you know, sir, I don't believe it's my rotator cuff. He got so insistent that he said, I know it's your rotator cuff. We're going to take an x-ray. And if I'm wrong, I'll pay for your x-ray.
Oh, wow.
And I said, yeah, I said, okay, you're on.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Guess what?
He paid for it?
He paid for my x-ray. Absolutely.
Well, at least he followed through.
Yeah, well, there you go. A man of his word.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's where it ended with him. He just said, well, I don't know. So that was it.
You know, but you do bring up a good point with the doctors. And for those, for our listeners here, I'm going to read a little segment of the article kind of about that, kind of the diagnosis part.
Yes.
He says, your doctor is saying, you know, you have fascial-humeral muscular dystrophy. You said, say what? And he said, it's a degenerative disorder. You'll probably lose the ability to show any kind of emotion as your facial muscles will no longer work. You will most likely lose the ability to chew, swallow, and blink. Most patients lose mobility, so you'll find a wheelchair helpful, and your shoulders will fall forward, making it impossible to lift your arms higher than your shoulder height. And then this is the part that I swear you were in the doctor's office with me, and he said the same thing. There's no treatment, no cure, but mine did not say, here's a brochure for the MDA. Call them for answers and support groups in your area. Any questions? He just simply told me, I'm sorry to say there's no treatment. There's no cure. I said, oh, well, that's great.
That was it.
Yeah. And I just kind of looked at him shocked. And my snarky, you know, side of me was just trying to fire something like, you got to say something back to this guy. And I think I was just in too much of shock. I almost, you know, I think honestly in my snarkiness, I think I said, so I have a chance. You know, so you're saying there's a chance that I can be all right.
I love it.
You know, it's like, I don't need that. No one needs that.
Yeah, no.
On any diagnosis.
Nobody needs to hear you don't have a chance to get better. That's because that's wrong.
Right.
There's always a chance. Right. I mean, we've got people working as we speak in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
Killing themselves to give us a chance.
Right.
And, you know, they have to tell you that. We need to tell people that have just gotten this diagnosis. And another thing, and I think I mentioned this in the article, the next day when I was living in that moment of, I don't have a chance, my life is over, you know, I'm never going to be able to smile at my children. You know, you're living in this weight of this diagnosis. You don't know how to call your family and say, hey, guess what, you know. And I remember I was sitting out on my porch, and I was just, the weight of it just was just so heavy. And my neurologist called me. He wasn't the one that gave me the diagnosis. I went to UCLA and had another person give me the diagnosis. They called him the next day, and he immediately called me on a Saturday. What neurologist, you know, calls their patients on Saturdays? This guy, Dr. Richard Spitzer, God bless his soul, he called me and he said, the most important thing anybody could have ever said to me on that day, he said, the doctor didn't give you muscular dystrophy yesterday. You've had it. You know, you were just given the diagnosis yesterday, but you didn't just get it yesterday.
Right.
You've been living a full life. There's no reason why you can't continue to live a full life. Don't let this diagnosis, you know, like be a weight around your neck and suddenly you stop living. You know, he said people that do that, I mean, it's almost bad. It's almost worse to give them a diagnosis because suddenly they know, uh-oh, I'm limited. I better not, you know, live life to the fullest. Don't let this do that to you. Just because you got diagnosed doesn't mean you just got it. You've had it all your life. And you've been dealing with it.
Right.
Keep dealing with it.
I totally agree. Absolutely. Yeah. But I think you're also correct in part of that where you got to grieve, you know, a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the first people I told was a boss of mine at the time, and she had MS.
Mm.
And I felt safe telling her, but even before I told anybody in the workforce, because we had a good connection, I thought if anybody can relate to this, it's her. So I told her. I was in my little office. She closed the door and she said, "You're going to grieve. It's going to feel like someone died.
Yep.
Let that be. Let that happen. You know,
somebody,
but no, it's normal.
Somebody did, Tim.
Yeah. Right.
Somebody did die. The
right.
person that you thought you were just died.
Yeah. Or the,
you know?
Or the person I thought I was going to be. You know, I'm like, what
exactly.
do you mean? What do you mean I'm going to be slower or weaker or what are you talking about? You know, it's like, yeah.
Yes. Yes. Mm. Exactly. You mean I'm not going to be able to climb Mount Kilimanjaro when I'm 60 like I had planned? Like,
right.
what? Okay.
I know. And the funny thing is, I lost my deposit on that trip. So, you know, it I'm just kidding.
Dadgummit. I lost mine too. Oh. Somebody's partying.
Yeah, I thought, forget it. Yeah.
Somebody's having a high time in Africa. Well, you know, it's really weird. I don't know where I got the idea to do this, Tim, but it really was a gift. And I know you know what I'm going to say, but I looked at the calendar and I gave myself 1 month. And I circled the 1 month mark from my diagnosis to a month, you know, from my diagnosis. And that month was, nobody wanted to be around me. It was ridiculous. It was vulgar. I mean, I had the biggest pity party, cried through things. I think I broke a few things. I mean, I really indulged in that grief. I felt every bit of it, every bit of it. And on that day, I said, okay, pity party's over. Let's figure out what my life is going to be like now. Let's move forward. You know, everything I thought I was going to be, like you just said, well, let's leave that. Now let's figure out who I really am, because that's who I was always going to be. I just didn't know that.
Right.
So, you know, let's figure out who, you know, who Heather, who Tim, who all of these people, you know, that are listening that have this disease, let's figure out who they really are, because this disease has has an amazing way of bringing out the fight in people. I think every chronic disease has the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Yeah. I've told people that I've talked to with this disease that I have it and this and that. And I've mentioned it on this show several times that it sounds weird and out loud, but this disease, especially the diagnosis with it, it opened my eyes and I think it made me better, a better person. It just went.
I can absolutely.
Yeah. I was like, wow.
Relate to that.
I'm like, wait a minute. This is something I have or diagnosis. And all of a sudden, something told me, well, hey, man, you're not the only one that got news like this today, probably. Oh, yeah.
Amen.
And I'm like, someone else.
Absolutely.
Everybody's got a something. If it's, you know, cancer
absolutely.
Or fighting depression or whatever it may be. Man, I don't want. You know,
oh, my God.
Not sympathetic, but I definitely got more in tune to, you know, people's, you know, struggles.
Yeah.
Like, wow, okay, this might be mine,
absolutely.
But everybody else must have one too. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, I don't know how many times I have said the words you just said, everybody has something, you know, some people can hide it better. Some, you know, we wear ours because we, you know, you can see ours. But everybody has something. Everybody has a fight that they struggle with every day. And, you know, it does make you more sympathetic. It does make you more empathic, you know. It's an amazing thing. And you know, a really weird thing, and I don't know if anybody will be able to really understand what I'm about to say, but it gave me answers as to what my limitations were going to be. I'm like, okay, all right, now I know the boundaries. Hmm. You know, I mean, right. You don't really know that in your life. And, you know, I mean, we're all going to have to face some kind of horrific news at some point in our lives. And, you know, it's like it's not about the news that you're handed. It's about what you do with it.
Yeah, I totally
it's
agree.
It's all about what you do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had a past. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that kind of falls into some of our guests that we've had one guest on that said, you know, making the whole, you know, taking lemons and making lemonade. You know, this is just what we have to do, and we compensate and we try to go forward and we figure out what we have to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, now you know your limitations. All right. Mm-hmm. So what can you do within those boundaries?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, A lot. I mean, I was the weirdo who liked to read true crime novels and could list every serial killer ever known, you know, and people were like, "Wow, you're so weird that you are interested in that." But guess what? Now that I'm a professional, I'm not a weirdo. Everybody wants to sit by me at a dinner party.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I want to know some of the interactions you've had with some of the casework. I mean, I'm like, this is pretty fascinating for me. I'm similar in that regard too. I just find that fascinating. I don't like gore or any of that. I just find how can a human do that,
actually,
or what makes their mind work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think that most people, whether they want to admit it or not, are fascinated with that, because we're all a little scared about what would I do if I was pushed a certain, you know, to a certain, you know, boundary or whatever, or am I capable of doing that? Do I know somebody who's capable of doing that? You know, and the weird footnote to this fellow that killed our family friend, I have to say this, and people that read my article, they know that it was a serial killer, and ultimately his last victim killed him. Mm. Talk about a story made for television or made for the big screen. Unbelievable story. If you want to look this guy up, his name was Wayne Nance. Amazing character. I mean, amazing as in horrible amazing. But I'm talking, when it was finally discovered that this fellow had killed, it was years later, decades later, that it was found that he had killed her, because once he was killed, they went in his apartment and found evidence that linked him to the killing of Donna. So I was at home in Montana visiting friends and everything, and I went by and sat and had a glass of wine with my next door neighbor. And we were talking, and literally we were next door, within feet of each other in Hamilton. And we, you know, it was like part of my extended family. And we were talking. I said, "What about this guy, you know, that killed Donna, blah, blah, blah?" I said, "You know, he delivered furniture." And she said, "He delivered the table and the chair that you're sitting in, sitting at right now."
Wow.
I was like, "You've got to be kidding me." This man that has sparked this whole fascination with me, that now here I am, you know, in this field. He was within literal inches of me when I was a kid. I mean, it was just mind-boggling. It was mind-boggling. And I think that's another thing that we all wonder is, like, how close have I ever gotten to one of these guys? Have I ever been, you know, anyone ever looked at me with that kind of intention? I mean, there's a population of people that, you know, we wonder about. We wonder if we have that in us or whatever. But ultimately, we know it's a small minority that step over that line and live that life. And it is fascinating. And I give people just an open invitation to learn about that. Don't feel bad about wanting to learn about that behavior. The more we know, the more powerful we are to stop it and the more powerful we are to recognize it.
I agree. Yep, absolutely. So why don't
Information's power.
Absolutely. It kind of works on your defense system then a little bit. You know, it kind of strengthens it,
absolutely,
in my opinion.
Yep.
So backing up, right, we know what kind of spawned your interest to want to get into this line of work. You're a forensic psychologist now. How hard, though, was
I'm not quite a psychologist.
Walking
into my doctoral.
Okay, so walking in. So you're still on the path.
I have a master's in forensic psychology, forensic mental health counseling. I also have a bachelor's in forensic anthropology, and I'm certified in forensic science and forensic facial reconstruction. But I don't have my doctorate yet, but I will in a couple years.
So how hard has that journey been for you, you know, to start school? You said you never had college background, and then to get where you are now. Hard, right?
You know, Tim, in some ways, it's the easiest thing I've ever done. Hmm. I know it sounds weird, but the hardest thing for me was I walked into my first class at 50 with a college rule spiral notebook and a number two pencil. And I walked into a class with all these kids with laptops, and they're looking at me like, yeah, who's this dinosaur? And what is that you have in your hand? And I mean, for the first year or two, I was like struggling, not with the work, with trying to figure out all the computer portals and getting my work through certain, you know, Blackboard and all. I mean, that's where I struggled.
Totally new to you.
After having, totally new, but the easy part is somebody's telling you what to do, how to do it, when it's due. You know, I mean, when you've had life for 50 years, you know, just winging it and figuring it out all on your own, and you have somebody telling you exactly what to do, that was the easiest thing I've ever done. Like, oh, okay, I could do this. So actually the work, I was eating it up. I mean, every single class. And as a matter of fact, I decided when I go back, if I'm going to go back to school, I'm going to be an A student. I'm going to sit in the front row, in the middle seat, in every single class. I'm not going to miss a class. I decided to be the biggest nerd that ever lived. And ask anyone that went to school with me.
Yeah.
I fulfilled that to a T. You know, I asked every question I wanted to ask. I thought if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. I'm going to act like every single class is just me in the room.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to depend on anybody else. I'm not going to wait for anybody else to ask a question. I'm going to ask it. And what I learned was so many of the students are so much younger. They are nervous to ask questions or to admit that they don't know what's going on or something. I didn't care. And I realized that I could be a leader in a lot of things. And then I became a leader in a lot of the student interests. I represented the students of the University of Montana, you know, for their interests. I made sure that they were taken care of. I represented them with the student council and stuff. So I absolutely went into it 100% and loved it. And the only school I wanted to go get my master's in was John Jay in New York City. Now, I'm in Missoula, Montana, the University of Montana, living in Hamilton. This is a big, big, you know, like, come
on,
Heather.
Yeah.
That's a huge leap. And I made it. I got accepted in the country's best forensic school in the city of all cities. And without the help of friends and family that made my way, that helped me move out there, that helped me secure an apartment. I mean, it was a group effort. And because of that, I felt like I owed it to everybody that got me there to do my very best. And to, you know, to make an impression on that school, make sure they knew I was there, and, you know, to absolutely do my best. And I was so proud in my last year at John Jay. I worked with Louis Schlesinger. If you've ever seen any true crime show, you've seen his face 100 times. He's the white-haired guy with the Fu Manchu mustache.
Yeah.
He is a god in forensics, and he was my professor for 3 classes.
Wow.
Amazing, amazing man. And my last class, he handpicked, everybody wanted to work with the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit. Everyone wanted to work with them. That's, you know, that's the pinnacle. And we all applied to work in this research with them. And he handpicked the people he thought were capable of handling it. And I'm proud to say I was handpicked by Louis Schlesinger, Dr. Louis Schlesinger, and went into research with the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit. And I had an amazing team with Sarah and TK and Sneha. They were an amazing team of young women. And we dove into it. We chose to work with stalkers that end their stalking with homicide. It was brutal, Tim. We were given clearance into the FBI lab. We were given thousands of files that were, every single file was at least one homicide. And we had to read through every single file, every single case file, and find out if any of these people had stalked their victims before they killed them. Now, that's a sentence, but in that sentence is a ton. I mean, there's so much. If you can imagine every day going in here and looking at dozens of case files of homicides, looking at the crime scenes, looking at the autopsy photos, reading victim statements, you know, and doing all this stuff. We were warned by the FBI, there's going to be a point at which you're going to get burned out. You're going to freak out. You're going to, you know, you're going to start having flashbacks. You're going to start having nightmares. And I thought, come on, I've seen a lot up to now, you know,
yeah.
We can handle this. And we were spending 4, 6, 8 hours sometimes in the FBI lab. I mean, looking at hundreds of crime scenes and sometimes videos. Some of these homicides were videotaped, if you can imagine.
Wow.
So you've got all this in your head, and I felt like I was handling it well. People were dropping like flies, like, okay, do you need to take a few days off? You need to take a week off? And I'm like, not me. Not
yeah.
me. I'm doing good. One day I went back to the apartment, and my daughter was living with me, and I walked in, and I was taking my shoes off, and I had spent about 6 hours in the lab that day, and she, you know, how was work at the lab? She knew I loved being there. And
yeah.
I just looked up at her and just burst into tears.
Wow.
Just had a major meltdown. And that day I had had to look at about 3 or 4 cases of child homicide. And that's just not easy for anybody to look at. I don't care how many files you look at. I don't care how many dead bodies you look at. When you have to look at a child, an innocent child, it's more than anybody should ever have to, you know, endure. So I called my supervisors that I think I need a few days off.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was human after all. yeah.
That's
and,
good.
And it's great to know that these people that do this every day, they have their limits. They have to take breaks. It's not normal to look at the things we look at. It's not normal. And, you know, and as much as we have to look at it so that we can help people and prevent people from being victims, we do have to protect our minds and our hearts along the way. And I'm learning that. I'm learning to get to a point and say, okay, I need to stop before I get to that point. So.
Here's a question, right? I mean, you talk about this kind of work being very intense, and people know about this, I think, line of work mostly through movies or TV. You know, Netflix, I think they just had the season 2 of, I can't remember.
Mindhunter.
And I've watched
Mindhunter.
I guzzled the heck out of that thing, you know, as quickly as possible. You know,
if
they made 100 episodes, I would have watched them all. So I'm into it, you know. And How, what is, you know, let's say TV versus reality, you know?
Yeah.
What are the main big differences? And is there anything that is, you know, that TV gets right in your opinion?
That's such a great question. I'm the worst person to sit and watch those shows with. The worst.
Okay. Well, you're not invited over.
My sister. Yeah, exactly. My sister loves CSI and she lives in Spokane. Hi, Dawn. And I was in New York and we actually synced up our computers one day. We're going to watch. I never watched CSI, never saw it in my life. She said, you have to watch it. And she loved it. And, you know, like 3 minutes in, I'm like, oh my God, come on. They wouldn't do that. Those guys are crime scene analysis. They're not going to be questioning suspects. I was horrible. Yeah. She's like, okay.
That's
never
enough of that.
I'm kind of horrible about it. But actually, when Mindhunter was about to be released, it was the buzz at John Jay. Because John Douglas was the Mindhunter. He's the one that this is about. He's the one that really started the whole crime scene analysis. He's the one that said, I'm seeing trends here. I think if we study these people, we can, you know, find out information that's going to give us, you know, a leg up on these guys. John Douglas, if anybody wants to read the ultimate in true crime or how it really is, get the book Mindhunter by John Douglas.
I'm writing it down.
Incredible book. So, of course, we had, you know, Mindhunter by John Douglas was like the Bible of forensics, you know, and forensic psychology. And so we're all excited. And the first episode comes out, and I'm like, ah, you gotta be kidding me. No! I mean, I watched like two episodes and said, nope, not watching this. Gratuitous sex and then, you know, all this stuff, right. And they're trying to get campy with it and everything. Anyway, but I have to say, I have friends that are in forensics and they said, you have to give it another shot. You have to go back and give it another shot because season two came out. It's amazing. The casting is amazing with these guys and everything. I said, okay. So just about 3 nights ago, actually, I jumped back into season one. I got all the way through, I think, 6 episodes. And I have to say, it really does get a lot better.
Okay.
And every episode got a little closer to reality. But as far as real goes, if anyone wants to know what the most real show is, Forensic Files still is it. It's still the top show that ever was made for television with true crime. Forensic Files beats them all. So, and I think it was one of the very first ones.
Okay. I'm gonna tune in.
They're great.
Yeah.
I don't know. Have you ever seen Forensic Files?
I don't think so. It sounds familiar.
Oh my gosh.
But.
I guess it was one of the very first ones, very first shows, and then other networks. I guess I'm not sure how it works, but they bought the shows and they would show it under a different name. So it had different names depending on what network showed it. So you may have seen it under a different name. But do a search for Forensic Files. You can get it. It's on Netflix. They've got tons of episodes. They've got literally dozens of episodes.
Okay.
And hundreds of episodes. Wow. I heard hundreds out of my daughter's bedroom. Hundreds of episodes. And my poor daughter knows way too much about murder. And it really gets it right. They're amazing. So if anybody wants to see what really happens behind the scenes, Forensic Files, that's the best show on, really. But they've got some amazing, incredible shows now. If anybody wants to write like the ultimate network to watch, Discovery ID is amazing. They have some incredible shows, really amazing shows.
So what is in your future? Obviously you have some more, you know, schooling to do and all that, but what's your ultimate goal with when the education is all done and all set?
My ultimate goal, and one reason why I am set on getting my doctorate, is because if you have a doctorate, you can do counseling online. Without a doctorate, you cannot. And since I have this disability and it's degenerative, I don't know how bad it's going to get. To have the ability to work by just sitting in front of my computer,
yeah,
is, I mean, what could be better? You know, you don't even really have to wear pants if you don't want to. But,
I suppose.
Isn't that what we all strive for with our work?
Right. Just to be comfortable.
Pants optional.
Yes.
But if I have a doctorate, I can receive files from any cases anywhere in the world. I can advise. If I have a doctorate, I can be a professional witness in court. Mm. Without a doctorate, I cannot. Mm. And so there are so many advantages as somebody with a disability like this one to have a doctorate. It's almost, you know, it's almost imperative that I do that. I will not be getting a PhD. I'll get what's called a PsyD. PhD is research focused, and PsyD is clinically focused.
Okay.
PsyD is still a doctorate, but it focuses on face-to-face work instead of research. And that's really where I want to be anyway, is I want to be working face-to-face. Just because I have special training in forensics and with forensic mental health counseling, I still will be just your regular run-of-the-mill psychologist and counselor as well. Hmm. So my ultimate goal is to move back to Montana. The house I have now, and I still have a home in Montana, it isn't real, it's two stories, no elevator. It's really not good for me anymore. So I plan on selling it and building a house that works with my disability. And with that house, I want to build treatment offices and treatment rooms. I'm trained in group therapy and I'd like to bring in music, since music is in my background, and art. I want to bring in art and music into my therapy with people that I'm going to be working with. I can work with substance abusers and people that are just coming out of incarceration. I'm not going to have people at my house that have been involved in violent crimes. No,
right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But I can do that online if I have my doctorate. So my ultimate goal in the next 10 years is to have my doctorate, have my house, have my treatment rooms in Montana, and be able to just stay in Montana and do my work there. I can work with anybody with the internet. Anything mm-hmm. is possible. And be able to have treatment for my regular patients and everything in right around my home in the beautiful Bitterroot Valley. So I'm pretty focused on that every day. That's my vision and that's what I'm working for. But now, I'm in Central California. I had been accepted to work at Corcoran, which is the California state prison. Mm-hmm. I was scheduled to start work there. That's where Charles Manson was held. That's mm-hmm. where Rodney Alcala is held. I mean, some of the worst of the worst. The week I was scheduled to start work, there was a horrendous homicide, and I will not go into the details, but just suffice it to say it was horrendous. And unfortunately, people that live in those conditions are highly reactive. And when one inmate does something that's pretty awful, it's sort of like this wildfire that creates this environment that is highly toxic, very dangerous, especially for somebody who has mobility issues.
Yeah.
And so my start date kept getting delayed. And the reason I was going to do my clinical hours here in California was because I needed to come out here and help my father who was terminally ill. And so I was going to do my clinical hours here. Well, my father, like I said earlier, sadly passed.
Mm-hmm.
And then my start date kept getting delayed here. And so I thought, there's really no reason for me to be here. I think I'm going to move my hours that I need to earn, my clinical hours that I need to earn, back up to Montana. It looks like I may be doing work with some correctional facilities there. And then where I'll be getting my doctorate is sort of in the air right now, but that'll be decided in the next couple of months.
Awesome.
So Wow. Sort of everything kind of got weird when I got to California. Everything was set in stone.
That.
And then I know this has really been one of the toughest years of my life. But you know, people that have had a diagnosis like we've had, you learn that whatever happens, it's not the end of the world. Your world just may look a little different, and you just need to make some adjustments, allow that grieving. Just, you know, like I said, get ugly with it if you need to for a few days, but don't live there.
Yeah.
You know, and wash your face up, put your big girl and big boy panties on, and figure out, okay, where do I go from here?
Right.
You know, what does it look like from here? It's so important not to just live there indefinitely.
Yeah.
If you have to, do like what I said. Put a red circle around a date on the calendar in a week, in a month. If you need 2 months, do it. But have a definite ending to that grief when you're given your diagnosis, or when you have a year like I've had where everything just went to hell in a handbasket. You know, lay in bed, eat Rocky Road ice cream until you put on 10 pounds, go through a couple boxes of Kleenex, do what you need to do, and then, you know, acknowledge that red circle on your calendar, get out of bed, and go figure out what you're going to do from here.
That's awesome advice. That's awesome advice. Well, thank you, Heather, for being here today on the FSH Society Radio Show. I tell you, your story is inspiring. I loved the story on FSHSociety.org site, and what you brought here tonight was incredible. Yeah, thank you very much for being here.
It was an honor. Thank you so much. And if anybody, you know, sees my stuff on the show or has any questions about my life, I don't know if my email is available on FSH, but I'll find out if I can offer it.
Okay.
Because I want to make sure that I'm available to people they have questions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're in this together, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We right. sure are. And I think we're all excited that you're on our side. You're in our corner. So we do appreciate that for
Thank
sure.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Tim. I appreciate so much being here tonight. I feel so honored. So thank you again.
Thank you. Good night.
Mm-hmm. Good night.
So that is Heather Green. Awesome. Awesome guest. Fantastic person. Obviously, a story that should inspire you a little bit, right? I mean, come on. You got to get after it sometimes. You get over the grieving, move forward, and, you know, get on with your life, because you weren't diagnosed, right? Or didn't get the disease on the day you were diagnosed. You've had it. You've compensated your whole life. That's something that I try to tell myself all the time. And it's hard. It's hard to get over those feelings. It's hard to get through. I get it. It's not easy. It's not easy. But you got us, your group, your community, your family. Lean on those friends, family, like I said, our community. And we'll help each other. That's how this works. Speaking of community, getting together, we got some great news of things coming up. I want to kind of get to it as we close up shop here. This, you can all find what's going on in the FSH Society world, as in meeting groups and this and that, all on fshsociety.org. Most of it's actually, you can just link it right on the homepage. First off, we're going to go through it here. August 31st, Daytona Beach chapter meeting at Christ Community Church, Dayton Beach, Florida, Saturday, August 31st, 1 to 3. September 5th, the FSHD Connecticut Connections. That's coming up 7 to 8:30. That's a virtual meeting. September 7th, Colorado Walk and Roll Secure FSHD, 8 to 12, that's 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. on Saturday, September 7th. That's at the Philip S. Miller Park in Castle Rock, Colorado. There's a trend starting here, so be aware. On the 7th as well, another Walk and Roll. That's at that's in Utah, Sugar House Park, Salt Lake City, Utah, Saturday, September 7th, 8 a.m. to 12. September 11th, there's a webinar about CBD and medical marijuana. That's right. I know Gina Solomon posted that on FSH Society's live Facebook feed page here, right here, on some links and stuff that she thinks you should take a look at. Kind of going and coinciding with that, there will be a webinar talking about those things. So there you go. We hear you. We hear you, Gina. Okay, September 14th, Chicagoland Walk and Roll to Cure FSHD. Another one, Citizens Park Amphitheater, Barrington, Illinois. That is the Chicagoland one. I'm going to try to make it to that one. So if you want to come meet me and my boys and my wife and family and stuff, we're going to make the trek down, join Dave Lucas and his crew, and do some walking and rolling. There's another one on the 14th, Columbus Walk and Roll at Kauffman Park Pavilion in Dublin, Ohio. That's 8 a.m. to 12 p.m., just like the Chicagoland one. Another one on the 14th, St. Louis is doing. They are Central Park, Chesterfield, Missouri. That's 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. September 15th, the Bay Area Walk and Roll, Alameda Point in Alameda, California, Sunday, 8 a.m. to noon. So much going on just in September here. Holy cow. Couple more for you. South Carolina FSHD Community and Chapter Startup Meeting on the Surfside Library, Surfside Beach, South Carolina. I think I want to go there just to go to Surfside Beach, South Carolina. That's 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Also on the 21st of September, East Tennessee Meeting and Social Gathering, the House of Peggy Glenn in Knoxville, Tennessee. That's 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Western Washington FSHD Community Group Meeting, Saturday, September 28th, 10 a.m. to 11:30. That's on the 20th. And finally, the... What do we got here? Atlanta Walk and Roll. Another one, September 29th, at the Chattahoochee Natural Center, Ben Brady Lakeside Pavilion, Roswell, Georgia. Saturday, September 29th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. I think I got them all. That must be the most going on in the calendar coming up. Tons of walk and rolls. Get out to the events. Join a chapter. Find a chapter. Join mine if you want, because it sounds like I'm going to be hopefully roping in and connecting in with Minnesota and possibly Michigan as well. Why not? Let's make it the Great Lakes. Special thank you to all of you for being here on the FSH Society Radio Show via Facebook Live. You can find this episode and many others anywhere you find podcasts. That's right, on Spotify, or I think it's Apple iTunes and TuneIn, and pretty much you name it. I flood it out there and share it, replay it, share it with your friends if they missed the live show. We'll be here again next month as we bring in our special guest, David Younger. Check him out, dbyounger.com. Do your homework, get your questions going. Bring those next month on the, I believe, 25th of September. Heather Green was our guest on this show. She was fantastic. We'll have her contact information out there, but you can read her story at fshsociety.org. So that ends another episode. Thank you all for being here. Phenomenal time. Love spending it with you all. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next month on the FSH Society Radio Show. In the meanwhile, you can contact me, fshradiohost@gmail.com. Take care. Good night. We'll be right back.